Cytiva, now with the life sciences business from Paul, is a global provider of technologies, services, and expertise to help researchers and companies protect and preserve the planet for improved human health and safety. With a rich heritage dating back hundreds of years, Cytiva brings a wealth of technical expertise and talent, a broad and deep portfolio, and exceptional service to help researchers and industry labs at every stage from source to shelf. Visit Cytiva.com to learn more.
This is the Master Brewers Podcast, brought to you by the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, a volunteer organization dedicated to continually improving the products and processes of our membership since 1887. Let's go! 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 Master Brewers brings you interviews with the industry's best and brightest in brewing science, technology, and operations.
Calm down, I'm moving too fast.
This episode was made possible by the following sponsors.
Discover more ways to enhance flavor and maximize beer yields with Salvo. Now available in varieties like Sultana, Trident, Lotus, Calypso, Cascade, and many more. Discover how Salvo can help boost your brew at hopsteiner.com.
Berkeley Yeast, creators of diacetyl-free yeast strains. Diacetyl-free strains are bioengineered to produce the ALDC enzyme inside the yeast cell to keep diacetyl low during fermentation and after packaging. Diacetyl-free strains create the cleanest flavor profile possible, which makes them the yeast of choice for the most exacting brewer. Go to berkeleyyeast.com to read about how brewers are using diacetyl-free strains to propel their beers to the top of the podium.
Attention all brewing professionals dedicated to operational excellence. Enhance your brewing processes with Brewmax by ProLite. Our sophisticated brewing management software is designed to optimize production, ensuring the highest quality brews. Unleash the full potential of your brewing operations. Visit our website to learn more. Brewmax, empowering brewing excellence from grain to glass.
What you're about to hear originally aired in October of 2020. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode that you won't want to miss.
And then in 1881, which is a really important date for Guinness, is that we purchased our first microscope. And then from 1883 onwards, every brew was assessed using that microscope. Is it the same yeast that Arthur Guinness would have picked up in 1759?
This week on the show, the story of Guinness yeast. Is it unique? Is it Irish? Join us as we peek into the St. James Gate Yeast Library.
My name is Daniel Carouche. I'm the group microbiologist for Diageo.
The past has been well documented at St. James Gate. Beyond the libraries of bottles, furniture, and marketing materials, there's also a yeast library. Tell us what's in it.
What isn't in it, I think, is probably the most pertinent question. It's a treasure trove, an absolute treasure trove of yeast and bacterial species that have been, well, in terms of the bacteria, kind of been isolated from various different vats over the years. And the yeast is kind of, well, it's the Guinness yeast. So the Guinness yeast is, you know, very prevalent there, as you'd expect. But it's also yeast from other breweries as well, you know, that I've kind of delved into. There's an awful lot in there. There's about 300 yeast species, over 300, and at least 200 bacterial species. Fortuitously, actually, every single one of the yeast and every single one of the bacteria has been incredibly well documented. So we know exactly where it came from. We know the provenance of it. We also, for a lot of the yeast, we also know its fermentation abilities as well, including whether it's POF positive or not. So it produces that phenolic off flavor, and also kind of the ester profiles that you can see from the yeast as well. It literally is a treasure trove of microorganisms that have been used in the brewing environment.
What was special about 1903? Why was that the starting point here?
So 1903 is when we can relate all of our yeast back to. And the reason being is that in 1901, because of the work of the first scientist that Guinness appointed, Thomas Bennett Case, we set up the Watling Laboratory. And the reason why they set up that laboratory was because they were very keen, and they still are very keen, Guinness, to kind of drive performance through scientific understanding. So all of the yeast that we use today in our brewery can be related back to that yeast that's kind of was stored down in 1903.
What can you tell us about where Guinness yeast most likely came from?
Yeah, so in 1759, Arthur Guinness signed his famous lease. But this was Arthur Guinness's second brewery. So his first brewery was actually in Leixlip, but he moved to the capital and he set up his brewery in 1759. For the first 40 years, Arthur Guinness brewed primarily ales, but he did brew the odd number of stouts. And then in 1799, they made the conscious decision to move production away from ales to what was quite popular at the time, which was the porter style, which was coming out of London. And actually, that then became the beer that we now and know love today is Guinness Stout. The first record we have kind of within the archives of when of yeast is in 1809. And the reason we know that is because in 1809, they closed the brewery for about 3 weeks because they had to put a new steam engine in there. And what they did is that they then obviously the yeast died. But what we know is that they brought yeast in from three specific breweries. And all these breweries were in the vicinity of Dublin. We then kind of between 1810 and 1812, we then have a further information that they brought in 41 brews from seven different breweries. Now, obviously, in those days, they didn't really know what yeast was, but they knew that they needed this thing that fluffed up. So what was quite common practice was that you would never refuse another brewer, kind of like a seed, if you see what I mean. So they brought the... What would have happened is that they would have brought the seed into the brewery, they would have allowed it to ferment for 2 to 3 days, and then they would have pushed that seed then into the brew. Obviously, in 1854, the great Louis Pasteur discovered what yeast was, as it were. And then in 1881, which is a really important date for Guinness, is that we purchased our first microscope. And then from 1883 onwards, every brew was assessed using that microscope, which, if you think about it, is actually quite it's great foresight, really. As I mentioned before in the last question, the appointment of Thomas Bennett Case in 1893 was instrumental and kind of vastly improved the kind of the scientific understanding of Guinness. And then obviously then they established the Watling Laboratory in 1901. Just to go back to kind of the question about where did the Guinness yeast come from, what we do know is that Arthur Guinness in 1759 would have borrowed yeast from other brewers within the vicinity of Dublin. And obviously then he would have then obviously given his yeast to other brewers within the vicinity of Dublin as well. So that yeast would have then been shared in and around Dublin.
Okay, and then something else important occurred in 1959. What was that?
Yeah, so the great work by Gilliland. So Gilliland was basically the preeminent microbiologist for Guinness during the 20th century. He had a very illustrious career, was with Guinness for many, many years, and was a highly successful scientist. But he was kind of instrumental in taking that 1903 yeast, and he did a reselection in 1959, and he based it upon flocculation characteristics. So interestingly enough, the EBC method, so the European Brewing Congress, their flocculation method is actually called the Gilliland method after the work that he did at Guinness. So he selected this yeast. It's a class 2 yeast, so it's not super flocculent at all. It says what you class as kind of poor flocculence, really. And he decided that was the best yeast at that time for making Guinness, and that's the same yeast that we still use today. And one thing he then did in 1960 is that they then decided to use a variant of the 1959 yeast, and that's the foreign extra stout yeast, and that's the other yeast that we use today to brew the other kind of Guinness, which is the foreign extra stout, and that's the yeast that we use primarily to brew beer in Africa. And foreign extra stout is a bit of a different beast than Irish draft stout Guinness. It's got a very high diacetyl. It's got a much stronger ABV. It's usually between 6.5% to 7.5%. But the big thing, and the reason why they chose that yeast was because that they wanted the yeast to remain in suspension for as long as possible. So it's an extremely poor flocculant. The yeast is described basically as unflocculant, and it's the same reason why you would have had the old English IPA, where they brewed it at high strength so that it could then go on long journeys. But that was the same thing with the foreign extra stout. It was brewed at high strength so it could go on long journeys.
Awesome. Well, you just answered my next question, so that's good work. Daniel, what can you tell us about how those strains were stored in 1903?
So basically what they were stored on slants, and then after every 6 months they were they were put on more slants, essentially. So every 6 months, the microbiologist would take the yeast, wash them off, and then grow them up and then put them on slants. And that's how it was basically stored for many, many years, up until the early 80s. And in the early 80s, obviously, the Guinness decided to buy some liquid nitrogen storage, and that's how the yeast has been stored ever since. So since the early 80s, basically, all of our yeast has been stored in liquid nitrogen.
That's interesting. You know, I just looked it up right before this because I had no idea, but cryogenics is a lot older than I would have guessed. Apparently, James Dewar's famous invention goes all the way back to 1892. So I found that interesting. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask, how were they storing this way back in 1903? So that's pretty interesting.
And I think one of the things actually from the work that we've done actually is testament to just how good Guinness's microbiologists were. Because what we found is that even though we've gone back to look at yeast from 1947, which is the earliest Guinness yeast kind of within our collection, and it's so closely related to the yeast that we use today. And it just shows you just how well the microbiologists were able to replate every 6 months, and it's just testament to their skills, actually. And what's interesting is that when I've gone and looked at other yeast for other different projects, none of them are contaminated, and they're just it just shows the testament just how good our microbiologists were.
Wow. Okay, Daniel, so with the access to this library of all these different yeast and the ability to leverage modern technology, you set out to determine the origins of Guinness yeast and figure out exactly what makes Irish yeast Irish, right?
Yeah, so the project originally started with kind of determining, process and all that kind of stuff. And one thing we became interested in is that if there's been some great works in this area over the last couple of years. So there's been some great works by Kevin Verstappen's group, by Galone and Stencils, and also by Goncalves from Portugal. And what they've been able to do is they've been able to appropriate geographical domestication by what we call single nucleotide polymorphisms, but basically mutations. So what I was interested in, or what we were interested in, was taking the Guinness yeast and kind of trying to work out where its origin was from. When we did the first piece of work, we looked at a total of 16 Guinness yeast, and the oldest one being from 1947 and the latest one being from 1981. And we then looked at it from our different breweries. So we had the Irish brewery, which is St. James's Gate, but we also used to have a London brewery called Park Royal. And so what we did is we took all those yeast and we basically had a look at them to see whether the first thing we were interested in is that were they quite closely related? The second thing we were interested in is that phenotypically, i.e. how they behave, did they behave in a similar manner as well? So what we were able to do is we took these yeast, we basically did full genome analysis of them, and we were able to determine what the bases were, the A's, the C's, the G's, and the T's. And we were also able to determine these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And then what we then did is we then downloaded the Galone and Stencils extensive library of yeast. You can download those if you so choose to. They actually did that piece of work with Chris White, so White Labs. And what we were able to do was we were able to place our yeast within the context of all of their yeast. And what's interesting is that the Guinness yeast on their form what we call a monophyletic group, so they group on their own. And what we found very strange is that when we start to look at these yeast, we would have expected them to kind of group with yeast from kind of Britain, and that wasn't the case. Actually, when we started to look at these single nucleotide polymorphisms, we actually found that part of the genome was from Britain, as kind of you would expect, being as Ireland and Britain such close neighbours. But actually what we found was that about 30% of the genome was kind of derived from yeast that were originally used to brew in the United States. So actually, in terms of its geographical location, our Guinness yeast is actually more closely related to the United States. And then the other thing that we found really interesting was that about 38% of the genome is actually not specified at all. So we don't really know where it's from. So a real hodgepodge, and not at all what we were expecting, considering A, the geographical location to Britain, and also when we look in the archives as well, we can clearly see that our Guinness yeast had come in from breweries within Dublin. So yeah, it was it's been an interesting journey.
You've already said that you, you know, did genetic analysis and fingerprinting of these different strains, and that you were able to group them. But you also did many fermentations with them as well, right?
Yeah. So what we did is we took the Guinness yeast out of the Guinness Library. We then did some giant colony morphology. So we grew them up on a WLNA agar. We allowed it to grow for between 10 and 12 days until we've got some really nice, big, fat, juicy colonies. And then what we then did is we then extracted the DNA, and using the ASBC method, actually, which is taken from LeGrasse and Kirst, their methodology from 2003, we're then able to basically determine kind of the fingerprint of these different yeast. And what was really great was using that method, we were able to see whether the yeast was pure, as it were, or whether we had kind of different variants within that. And then what we then did is we took kind of the typical and the atypical colonies, and we did mini fermentations with them. And then we kind of, in the mini fermentations, we were able to assess, you know, speed of fermentation, ABV. We were able to assess kind of ester formation and obviously higher alcohols. And for us as well, diacetyl is hugely important. We're probably one of the very few brewers that want high diacetyl beers. So we like big diacetyl producers. So we're also interested in diacetyl because it's a signature flavor of our foreign extra stout. So we really want a yeast that will overproduce diacetyl or alpha acetylactate before it gets converted into diacetyl. But yes, that's what we were really interested. So we were then able to analyze all those. And interestingly, what we found was that phenotypically, these 16 yeast that we looked at were actually quite different. Some of them fermented very, very quickly. Some of them were slightly slower. We also were able to see that the ester formations were very different as well as the higher alcohols and the diacetyl. But the thing that we found particularly interesting was actually the flocculation characteristics. So Gilliland, when he decided to choose the Irish Draft Stout yeast, he did it purely based upon its flocculation characteristics. And actually, when we look at the different Guinness yeast, we can see that they have different flocculation characteristics. And if you were to talk to an old Guinness brewer, they would clearly say to you that actually Guinness yeast historically is not a great flocculant yeast. But what we found is that actually within the variants that we looked at, some of them were actually quite flocculant.
So what did the various Guinness yeast strains have in common?
So one of the big things about Guinness is it's quite a rapid fermenter. So the Irish draft stout yeast and the foreign extra stout yeast, which are the main yeast that we use, are actually quite quick. Well, it's very quick. And interestingly enough, that when we looked at the Park Royal yeast, which is that other brewery in London, one of them reached attenuation within about 18 hours, which is actually incredible for 12 degree Plato wort, absolutely phenomenal speeds. The other thing as well is that they are all POF positive, so they all produce this phenolic off flavor. So that's another characteristic of the Guinness yeast. Obviously, when you drink Guinness, you won't have that.
You don't taste that.
No, absolutely not at all. And that's to do because, you know, we mash in it at a higher temperature, so we don't have the frulic acid stand. And in addition to that, we use well-modified malt, as most brewers do nowadays. So, yeah, and then it has quite – when I drink Guinness, I don't really actually get – it's not what I would call kind of a yeasty beer, if you know what I mean. Quite a lot of the attributes from Guinness are not actually derived from the yeast. But actually, in terms of production and in terms of process, the Guinness yeast just works fantastically well. And actually, the variants or the different other Guinness yeast we found – you know, pretty much kind of reverted to type in that, you know, they did ferment out quite well. The other thing as well is that they're usually quite strong alcohol producers as well. we've tried to kind of increase biomass, and obviously, you know, the old Crabtree effect, and the Guinness yeast just loves making alcohol. Absolutely loves making alcohol. So yeah. and we see that in the data that we've produced for the WBC presentation.
All right. You also did sensory analysis with at least some of these strains. Anything interesting to report on that front?
Yeah. So what we were, obviously, you know, we did these mini fermentations. You know, they're only 120 mils. You can do the analytics, but the important thing is that the mini fermenters can that be transferred to a larger fermenters? So the characteristics and the phenotypes we saw in the mini fermenters, would we see them in the larger fermenters? So what we did is in our pilot plant at St. James's Gate, we just brewed with three yeasts. So we brewed with a control yeast, which was the Irish Draft Stout, which is the one that we used to make Guinness. Then we brewed with a variant that we'd found within the Irish Draft Stout, which we called IDS2. And then we were also then interested in that yeast that fermented very, very quickly, which was the Park Royal yeast. And what was interesting was is that the small mini fermenters and all the characteristics that we'd seen in that were perfectly replicated almost in the larger fermenters in the 100 litres. So that Park Royal yeast fermented much quicker than the Dublin yeast. It was about 14 or 15 hours quicker in total. And obviously the flavour characteristics that we'd seen with the Park Royal yeast, you know, that it produces a lot of the banana flavour, the isomalt acetate, that came through strongly, and so did the phenolic as well. The phenolic actually we find very interesting, because what we did is we fermented it with Guinness wort, so we didn't have that ferulic acid stand. So maybe this yeast is hypersensitive to producing phenolic, and it's something that I think is probably worth exploring, but it wasn't part of this work. And then the other part of it as well was with the Irish Draft Stout, what we found is that was a real big diacetyl producer, and again when we did it in the large fermenters, it did produce diacetyl. And one thing we have in St. James's Gate is that we have a professional taste panel who are very good, and they were able to determine, you know, we put this through the taste panel, and they were able to you know, bring out all these flavors, which matched almost perfectly with the analytical data that we'd seen for the mini fermenters. So we were quite pleased about that.
Daniel, Guinness has a very pleasant level of acidity, a sort of a signature tang that I think helps make the roast character smoother. Is the yeast producing this level of acidity, or does that come from other ingredients or processes?
John, I can't answer that, I'm afraid.
Oh, come on.
You know, as much as I would love to, I think we'll have to leave that as part of the Guinness secrets. Even though Arthur would have taken it from in and around Dublin, that actually that yeast is almost bespoke, as it were.
I'm John Bryce, and you're listening to the Master Brewers Podcast from the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. There's really only one thing that keeps this podcast going, and that's when listeners like you take the time to thank our sponsors. The next time you talk to a rep from one of these companies, be sure to thank them for their generous support.
Rahr Malting Company is a fifth-generation family-owned business supporting breweries, distilleries, and allied industries around the globe. With modern malt production facilities in Shakopee, Minnesota, and Alex, Alberta, Canada, Rahr Malting Company maintains the traditions of quality and customer service that have been the standard of industry excellence for over 176 years. Learn more about the malt of reputation and Rahr's commitment to your success when you visit bsgcraftbrewing.com.
Get to know Proximity Malt. We malt superior, European-style, low-protein varieties grown close to home in Delaware and Colorado. Domestically grown, precisely malted to style. With our team of seasoned experts and two brand new malt houses, try what's really new in malt. Check us out at www.proximitymalt.com.
Positively impact your process, product, and profitability with actionable insights from BrewIQ, the industry-leading real-time fermentation monitoring solution. Visit www.precisionfermentation.com/MBAA to start saving time and money today.
Are you sure you're getting the best deal? Visit the Lupulin Exchange, where you can find every hop variety, every brand, and every vendor. Compare prices, reviews, shipping speeds, reliability, and more on over 1 million pounds shipping direct from every hop merchant and grower in the U.S. The Lupulin Exchange. One stop, all the hops. Are you headed to Vegas for CBC? If so, please come see me at the Lupion Exchange, booth 1281, in between YCH and John I. Haas. I'll have an awesome free t-shirt for you while supplies last, and I'd love to hear about your experiences on the exchange, what we could do better, and how I can earn more of your brewery's business. And here's what's coming up on the Master Brewers calendar. District St. Paul, Minneapolis has a bowling social April 2nd at Town Hall Lanes. District Rocky Mountain meets at Prost Brewing Company in North Glen April 10th. District St. Louis meets April 18th at Urban Chestnut. District St. Paul, Minneapolis meets May 9th at Shells Brewing in New Ulm. District Northwest meets in beautiful Hood River May 10th and 11th. The Master Brewers Brewery Maintenance Systems course begins June 6th. It's time to save the date for the 2024 World Brewing Congress. That's August 17th through the 20th in Minneapolis. And this year, the Master Brewers Brewing and Malting Science course runs September 5th through November 8th. Check out the full calendar of events at mbaa.com for more details or to find a district meeting near you. Now back to the show. What exactly did you learn about Guinness yeast after all this analysis?
Well, we learned a huge amount. I suppose the thing we learned most, though, is that this is just really very much the beginning of the story. So we've obviously, we have all the genetic information, so we know what genes are present. We also know the kind of the point mutations that are present. So as part of the WBC presentation, I talk a little bit about phenolic off flavor because, you know, this is a very well researched, very well understood pathway. And there's two genes in there, FDC1 and the PAD1 gene. And interestingly enough, if we then look at kind of those SNPs again, the single nucleotide polymorphisms, we know that there are two specific mutations that just belong to the Guinness yeast. So, you know, that kind of level of detail is across the whole of the genome. And what's interesting is that relating genotype to phenotype is hugely important. So what we're kind of interested in now is taking this kind of the data, the analytics, and kind of exploring the genome essentially. Interestingly enough, we've done this using a kind of next generation sequencing, which is great, the Illumina sequencing platform. And one thing we're quite conscious of is that there are other platforms out there at the moment. So we're doing a project at the moment where we're using the nanopore technology, which will give us better reads essentially, or give us longer reads, not necessarily better reads. And what we're hoping to do is elucidate further what genes are present within the Guinness yeast. So this is very much just the start of what I hope to be a very interesting and very productive piece of work for Guinness and also for myself.
Earlier you said that there were also some strains in the library from other Irish breweries, and you wanted to explore the concept of Irish brewing yeast terroir. Let's hear about that.
Yeah, so when we first started the piece of work, we started obviously with the Guinness yeast. And when we did all the genetic analysis, we found out that the Guinness yeast was quite unique, and that it's what we call a mosaic yeast. So its genome is kind of derived from different parts of the world. And what I was wondering was that, well, if this Guinness yeast, which is an Irish yeast, is so unique, are other yeasts from breweries that have brewed on the island of Ireland, are they also unique? So what we did is we took 32 yeasts from five different breweries that we had stored down. And the five breweries was Cherry, McArdle's, Perry, the Great Northern Brewery, and Smithwick's. And what we did is we did the ASBC method where the fingerprinting, and we actually found out that if we did kind of hierarchical clustering, we actually found that actually the 11 of these yeasts was actually quite closely related to the Guinness yeast. So what we then did is we took these 11 yeasts and we put them further for pushed it further for genetic analysis. So we did again, we did whole genome sequencing. And actually what we found is that four of the 11 yeast actually weren't Saccharomyces, they were hybrids. We think there are hybrids between Saccharomyces and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, but obviously that was that could be another project, so we decided to park that. And instead we took those seven yeast, those seven Irish brewing yeast, and what we did is we basically placed those within the wheel of both the Guinness yeast and also those yeast that we downloaded previously from the work by Galone and Stencils. And actually what we found was very interesting. We had assumed that those Irish yeast would be quite closely related to Guinness yeast and would actually form part of that, what we call that monophyletic group that we had with the Guinness yeast. And actually what we found is that this wasn't the case at all, and that actually those seven Irish yeast that we have are actually quite close related to Britain. So the yeast that had previously been described as being from Britain, those seven Irish yeast quite nicely fitted in with those British yeast, as it were. Maybe it shouldn't be called Britain yeast. Maybe they should be called Britain and Ireland yeast. But yeah, those seven yeast fitted quite nicely within there, suggesting that actually there was a common universal ancestor between all of those different yeast. But to go back to kind of the point about the Guinness yeast, it says that our Guinness yeast is completely unique. It says that our Guinness yeast, even though Arthur would have taken it from in and around Dublin, that actually that yeast is almost bespoke, as it were, and isn't related to any of those yeast that were used to brew beer in Ireland, which I think is quite stupendous, really. You know, in Dublin, a yeast that you have that's brewing kind of, you know, a very well-known brew, you'd have expected it to be of the same, exactly, and you'd expect it to have the same origins as other Irish yeast.
What can you tell us about the time period for those five breweries where those 11 yeasts were sampled? Was that did those samples also go back to 1903, or were they more recent, or do we know?
So most of those yeast were kind of isolated, were stored down, in the 1950s, in the 1960s. In the 1950s, 1960s, there was quite a lot of movement within Ireland in terms of breweries. For example, in 1962, the Irish Ale Brewing Association was set up, and that was with Guinness, Cherry, Smithwick's, and McArdle's. So they were kind of in the 50s and in the 60s, all of those breweries were kind of getting together, as it were. What's interesting is, though, that, you know, going is that breweries, obviously, you know, they would have shared yeast through over the years, and actually it would probably be quite common for those yeast to have already been in our collection. But in the 1950s, probably because of the work of Gilliland, actually, they were all stored down. There's an awful lot in the library around sort of between 1952 to kind of like 1968, where if you look at the library, you can see that they did an awful lot of work. So they were kind of going in and reselecting different yeast from the Irish breweries. I don't really know why they did that, but all I know is that I'm quite pleased that they did, because then it allowed us to do quite a nice piece of work based upon that previous work.
Maybe you can hypothesize that, you know, Guinness essentially, for whatever reason, did a better job of sort of preserving the strain that they had going back to the early 1900s. And then maybe some of these other Irish breweries, you know, selected a different strain that circulated among them or whatever, you know, at some point between then and the 1950s or 60s. Does that sound reasonable or no?
I kind of racked my brains about this for a long time. The truth of the matter is we don't know. But what we do know is that the Guinness yeast is very different from those Irish yeast.
Right.
We know that the Guinness yeast is a mosaic yeast. We know that its genome is from Britain, Belgium, the United States, and not specified. It's a mosaic yeast. And obviously, it's the same yeast that we've had since 1903. And the other thing to say as well is that in 1881, we had a microscope that was then used to analyze, you know, our fermenters. And as a consequence, Guinness as a company would have been cognitive of the importance of their yeast. So they would have been able to preserve their yeast. Now, obviously, we can only go back to 1903. But if, if you'll humor me a little bit, I think we could probably go back a little further. I mean, is it the same yeast that Arthur Guinness would have picked up in 1759? I don't know, but from the romantic point of view, I'd like to say yes. And the fact that this yeast would have then been used and pushed around Dublin, and gone to other breweries and come back into Guinness. I mean, we don't know. The other side of it with the Irish brewing strains, I think actually that supports just how good the Irish brewing was, essentially, because, you know, they do all have all these individual yeasts, which must have come from the same universal ancestor. And that universal ancestor would have also been the same universal ancestor that would have been used for Britain as well. I just think it's very interesting. I think the fact that this Guinness yeast is so completely unique when we compare it to other Irish and British yeast, I think is an interesting story. And the power of that yeast, with the way it processes and the way it ferments out, I think is probably the reason why it was managed to stay around and potentially beat other yeast that would have dropped in there, you know.
Okay, Daniel, what about the bacteria samples in the library? Or is that a project for the 2024 WBC?
We've done a little bit into it. It's a proper treasure trove. It's fantastic. I mean, the yeast stuff could keep me going for many, many years. And hopefully, if the WBC be so kind, we'd quite like to present maybe some more work on the yeast. But yeah, I mean, bacteria. I mean, phenomenal amounts of information in there. One thing to say, actually, as we're talking about kind of yeast, is that we do have a very interesting yeast that was isolated by Gilliland called it's a Brettanomyces species, which for brewers out there that are really into their kind of sour beers, this thing is fantastic. And we've brewed with it. We brewed with it in our pilot plant. One of our head brewers decided to take it on, and it produces this fantastic tropical kind of aromas. So with Brettanomyces, as you know, you get kind of these most, I think they describe them as kind of like barnyard flavors. But with this one, it's not so much that. It's a lot more kind of right estery and very, it's fantastic yeast. Anyway, that one's called Brettanomyces dublinensis, and that is a superb yeast. But that's kind of the flavor of the stuff that we have in our library. It's just, a treasure trove.
So, Daniel, just kind of curious, obviously, you know, Guinness has this rich, storied history. A lot of folks are interested in it. But, you know, where did you get your inspiration and for this project? And how did you access all this information? It seems sort of just seems incredibly daunting.
Well, full disclosure, John, I didn't go through all the rich history that we have with Guinness. What we have is for those of your listeners that have been to the Guinness storehouse, you will have probably noticed that we have the Guinness archives there as well. And that's run by a lady called Evelyn Colgan, who's just tremendous. So she's our principal archivist. She has another lady working for her as well. And Evelyn's done a fantastic job. You know, all the stuff about the Irish brewing yeast, she's kind of gone on and she's researched all that. And she's also researched an awful lot about the Guinness yeast. So, you know, the story about 1809 and 1810 and all that kind of stuff, that's all, we know that's fact because Evelyn has gone in there with other people. There's another gentleman called Dr. Eddie Burke, who's also done a tremendous amount of work as well. And they've gone into the history books, they've gone into the brewing records, they've looked meticulously at kind of when the brews were brought in, you know, when we shared our yeast with other breweries. And because there is just so much information, as you alluded to in the question, John, you know, going through all that kind of information has been quite a monumental task. And interesting enough, it's still very much an ongoing piece of work. We're bringing all the stuff that was in the old brewery in Park Royal, they were bringing some of that into St. James's Gate. And again, the amount of information in there is just phenomenal. And because we were so meticulously, or Guinness was so meticulously, so kept such meticulous records, we know phenomenal amounts. So we know, for example, that brews in 1809 were the yeast was taken in from a brewery from Sweetman's that's based upon in Dublin. We know all this kind of information, and it's actually testament to the work that Evelyn and the team have done, which has been great.
That was Daniel Karush here on the Master Brewers Podcast. If you want to know more, check out Daniel's WBC presentation, which is available on demand, just like the rest of the WBC content. Check the show notes for a link. Are you enjoying the Master Brewers Podcast? Let me tell you about a simple way you can help us keep making more. Take a minute to thank our sponsors. There's no way we could produce this show without generous support from sponsors like Hopsteiner, Proximity Malt, BSG, Precision Fermentation, and the Lupulin Exchange. So please, let them know you heard their message on the Master Brewers Podcast and that you appreciate their support.